how to start?
Well, you know, it's just writing. I mean,
here's something important to remember about dialogue.
Every word matters.
No, it doesn't.
They're vital.
I want to go to this place that I think it needs to go to.
The only thing that counts is what you see on the screen.
I will write like 4, 5, 6 hours a day.
And it will be a voice made of ink and rage.
Okay, I'm really glad you asked me that question.
Welcome back to the show. In this episode, I sat down with screenwriter Kurt Johnstad, who's written several movies with Zack Snyder, the director. In this interview, we talk about clean, minimalistic, visceral action, how to set the tone, his writing process, which started with a film called True Vengeance and has led to movies like 300, Act of Valor, 300, Rise of an Empire, Atomic Blonde, and most recently the two Rebel Moon films, Part 1, A Child of Fire, and Part 2, The Scargiver. We also talk about adapting Frank Miller for 300, how he met Zack Snyder doing commercials back in the 90s, what it means to write action scenes in a visceral way, how to set the tone, and much more. Here's my conversation with Kurt Johnstad.
You know, I was looking for, so I went to art school at a place called Cal Arts, and then I came down into town, and I was really just hungry and looking for every, you know, I was doing everything from back when movie cameras had film and like clapper loader and gripping and just like trying to figure out an avenue to tell stories. And then I looked at, you know, I looked at kind of all the jobs being on set and just seeing the flow and rhythm of a set and just thought, well, who, like, to make a movie or to make a music video or TV commercial, a cinematographer, a director, they need all these people. But who doesn't need all the people? Like, what, how can you be self-reliant in this business and self-generate and create work and create maybe, you know, a job for yourself? And that really, that's, it was kind of the, just, that was really like, okay, the writer, like, that's the person who can kind of just be in their, you know, in their little shack and, you know, type away. And so that was, I'd given myself, so that's really the quick answer. And I'd given myself really 10 years to have a career, kind of from my 20s to my 30s. And given that decade, like, I'll try to do this. And, you know, it's, and it's tough because I didn't, you know, I don't come from a family of the entertainment business. And I had a backup, you know, to do something else. And then by 30, I had had a career, or was, you know, feeling as though like I was heading in the right direction. Yeah.
What did that, because a lot of people are going to look at your IMDb and just kind of see the hits, right? What did that look like for 10 years? Like, how many specs did you write or some of those things?
I wrote three films before my first credit. And so the first credit is a film called True Vengeance, which is like a straight to video, kind of like in the 90s, it was like, it's kind of like the height of kind of the kickboxer and kind of blood sport, those kind of movies. And that's kind of the movie, it ended up being. Actually, I've never seen it. However, the cool thing about that story, and I think it, what's worth telling about that is I saw a movie. I was always just a fan of the movies. And I went and saw a movie, which will be unnamed, but I was like, I can write a better movie than that. Like, that's a disaster. Like, that was terrible. The action was, you know, I was 25 and I had an ego and I thought I knew better. And so I just, that's really, the fuel was, I was just pissed off that I spent $5 on this movie, on this ticket. And what came of that, the great thing that came of it, and it has certainly been a lesson to me, is that I wrote the script. It was cool. It got optioned. That was like a year or two process of just like getting re-optioned. And it was like a little like $1,000 or something to tie it up for a year. But I thought, okay, I'm a screenwriter now. And then, of course, it didn't go anywhere. But the great thing is, what I realized the value was, is that even if it's sitting on your shelf, it's your work, and you know, you might be able to monetize that at some point. And I'd kind of forgotten about it, moved on to a couple other things I was writing. And a friend of mine, who was a stuntman at the time, called me up out of the blue and said, "Hey, whatever happened to that script?" And I said, "It's sitting here. Like, you know, it fell out of, you know, development, and they didn't want to make it, so I own it." And I think that that's the essential part. One, that you own it for as long as you can. And two, it's the relationship with this friend. So the friend was just grinding his way, you know, climbing up the ladder. He recognized something interesting. He called me. And within 2 weeks, I had my first sale, real sale. And they were making the movie like in 2 months. Like they had a script that had fallen out, and they made my movie by the end of the year. And that friend was Chad Stahelski, who now is the director of all the John Wick movies. And so I had known Chad for many, many years. He was an instructor at the Inasano Academy, you know, where I trained martial arts. And we were just friends. And he, like, I owe my career in a lot of ways, not only to my hard work, but just to the luck that Chad was on a movie, their script fell through, he called me, and I was like, okay, great. And so, yeah, I think that the relationship part of maintaining relationships and having good relationships with people over decades, that's a really essential piece, you know, because it doesn't matter if it might be a stunt guy, or it might be a camera assistant, or it might be just somebody that has their ear to the ground. And if you can build those relationships and maintain friendships, it really goes a long way.
Was that first one meant to be like the type of vehicle where it was low budget, assuming you have a bunch of like serious fighters playing the main roles? Is that kind of how you thought about it?
No, I had kind of written this gritty kind of Japanese Yakuza, you know, kind of crime noir script. It became more of the actor who I still know, which is, you know, again, it's a very small town. So the actor who was the star in that film was a guy named Daniel Bernhardt. And he, you know, then he's always maintained his friendship over the years with me, but also certainly with Chad. And he's been in lots of, you know, tons of movies. He was a bad guy, one of the henchmen in Atomic Blonde. And so you'll see his face, but he kind of had this kind of rise as a kind of kickboxing action hero in the 90s. And that's when I first met Daniel. But I think it really speaks to the idea of like the movie that you see in your head is a very different movie than the one that comes out in the movie theater. That's just, you know, and it has always been that way. Even with the biggest movies that I've done, it's never the movie that I saw in my head, for sure. Sometimes it's better.
So you dropped a lot of breadcrumbs. You trained martial arts. You liked the 80s action movies. You know, Chad, obviously. What is your lane, and how do you write action on the page? Do you leave it up to the director, fight choreographer? Are you very detailed? Anything like that?
So I prefer what I do not do. It's a good question, because my style, if you were to read my scripts, if they have action in them, or if they're just a character scene with, you know, between, you know, a husband and wife or whatever, doesn't, you know, I'm a very lean writer. So those kind of action descriptions, I try to get as, you know, is clean and clear a setting and tone as possible to engage not only the actors, but first the readers, because I've got to have an executive read it, and I've got to keep them turning the page. So really it's about the efficiency is like making that kind of those descriptions very clean and very, you know, yeah, just very, very clean and minimalistic. That's my personal style. So when writing action, I don't, even though I know what a jab, cross, hook, cross combination is, I don't
write that, or a flying arm bar, or like scissor takedown. Like, I don't write any of that stuff because that's, you know, or even really geeking out and being like, it's an Ashigarami heel hook. You're like, okay, well, like, because nobody's going to know that except, you know, maybe Chad, if, or, you know, somebody who knows the arts intimately. But a reader just wants to know, for instance, like the Atomic Blonde stairwell scene. Like, I think there was some like description, like, Lorraine fights like a man, you know, it's elbows and knees, it's blood for blood, you know, and, you know, I mean, and, you know, and it descends down the hallway, because I know that, you know, I might just punch in and just give a little, like, you know, she takes an elbow across the face or a knee to the stomach and she's thrown down the stairs, but I won't go so detailed because I don't want to paint the fight choreographer and the director and people. I just want to set kind of the visceral, like, it's three against one, you know, it's not a fair fight, you know, that kind of thing. She uses her environment. She picks up whatever she needs to end the fight, and then let them, oh, okay, it's going to be a garden hose, or it's going to be, you know, all those kinds of things. So that's really kind of knowing those, having those skill sets allows me to kind of reduce things and not have to, write more about the feeling of the scene, but not the specifics of the scene. If that makes sense.
Is that kind of what you would advise action writers to do? Like, what you kind of described might be described as like Muay Thai, where Jason Bourne is a totally different style, but you don't necessarily say that in the script. Is that kind of how you see it?
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, and so, yeah, Jason Bourne, like the Bourne stuff is all Kali and, you know, the Filipino Malaysian Majapahit art. So, and because I know like Jeff Amata and Damon Carr, like these people like were my senior instructors at Dinasano Academy. So that's all these guys kind of came up, Dave Leach, we were all kind of coming up together. I was a little bit early. I mean, I was a little bit later than them. So they were my senior kind of instructors and students. And again, we were in our 20s. So what I'd say about that is, yes, I think that it's also very easy and it's a kind of an established thing. If you say in a script, like what I'll do is I'll use movie references for the reader. So I will say, it's a car chase. It's like Bullet, you know, on steroids, you know, through Times Square. So I'll just give like, okay, this is, you know, or it has the tension of, you know, a Frankenheimer movie, or like, you know, you can do things that inform the reader about style or tone, or give them a visual signature of a movie that you're referencing, you know. And now the kind of, a lot of times people are using things like, you know, it's a John Wick, it's Gung Fu, you know, in a bar, you know, and you're like, okay, like it's that kind of thing, because that brand is so well known now that Chad and Dave, what they created. But I do use movie references a lot, or, you know, sometimes I'll use painters or just art in a, you know, like it's an Edward Hopper diner, you know, and just like, so you're like, oh yeah, I know that painting, you know? And to that point, not necessarily about action, but setting the tone, because it's really about getting the reader engaged. And you see this, you saw this a lot in Atomic Blonde, which is like, I'm a huge fan of, in the script, the needle drops. So like this song is playing in the background because everybody's be like, oh my God, I know that AC/DC song, or I know that, you know, whatever it is song. And so as the reader's reading it, they're like, oh yeah, that's cool. Like I can see this being played out to that Miles Davis song, or that, you know, whatever that is, or maybe they even stop and like play the song. And I've had actors say that to me. I remember Christian Bale told me once, he's reading a script that I was working with him on, and he's like, oh my God, I can't believe you put that New Model Army song in. Like I was on a plane and I had that song in my iPod and I was listening to it. And so just things like that, draw people in to the page, because it's hard enough to keep people's attention. That if you can just make those little things that stand out, I think that that's important for any screenwriter. I mean, that's my style, but everybody needs to make their own style.
Did you always include those things? Did you ever worry about, you know, someone not like the rights to a song are crazy expensive? Like, is it okay just to say like a song like Thunderstruck plays so they get the idea, or how do you think about that?
No, yeah. So it's interesting. So I'll use Atomic Blonde, for example. So I had really had those needle drops. And then when Dave came on, he was like, oh my God, yes, the Bowie song. That's awesome. We should put in like 99 Luft Balloons. We should put in, you know, like he certainly had his ideas of like songs. So we did a whole, like his pass to get it ready to go shoot. He was like, let's just really focus on the really cool George Michael song during this fight scene. It's all the stuff. And I'm like, okay, awesome. And so there's this really lovely creative kind of coalescence that we came just around music and being fans. We were both kids in the 80s. So we're like, all right, this is cool. Right before we filmed, the bonding company or the insurance company that says, okay, here's the whatever the budget, you know, and we're going to go shoot this movie now. They're like, wait a second. Like, you can't have any of these songs in because we don't know if you're actually going to be able to get the rights to them. Like, if whoever it was at the point, if it was Universal or, you know, they're going to have to spend, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to put these in the movie. So we actually had to pull all of the needle drops, all of those musical cues out of the script for the shooting draft. But we knew, you know, because Dave was a fan, he's like, look, I'm going to get Bowie. Bowie's going to open and close this, you know, movie. It's just, you know, that he fought for that and he was willing to die for that. So we did have to pull it for shooting, but then he just put it back in post. Yeah. So, but I, you know, you don't, there's no like rights police if you're just like writing a script. Like, you know, if something's playing, you know, if something's playing on the radio, that's what's playing on the radio. And it's somebody else's job to secure the rights and, you know, make sure that people are paid later on. So I say, for me, I say, set the tone, let people know kind of the sonic environment that like your characters are in, if they're in a car or they're in a bar, like let them know that Springsteen's playing on the jukebox. Like that's cool.
So tell me, how did you initially get involved with 300? And then how did maybe studying Frank Miller shape up the way you write action or screenplays as well?
Yeah. Okay. So the quick is that kind of in that 20s to 30s time, I was just hustling, trying to figure out what I'm going to do in that decade. And I was working on a job on a music video, and I was pushing Dolly. You know, for a cinematographer that I was working with at the time. And so behind the camera, and the director was a young guy who was just out of art school. And we started talking, and after day two, it was a Paul Westerberg video. And after day two, he came up to me, you know, in a very lovely way. And he's like, oh man, I really enjoyed having you on the set. And that was fun. And he's like, you know, and I told him like, I was, you know, into rock climbing and, you know, just other things and just, you know, just young 20, maybe 2-year-old guy, just trying to find my way in Hollywood. And he's like, you know, I'm sure we'll run into each other. And I figured I'd never see the guy. He actually gave me a gift. He gave me he's like, I've got this pipe for you. Like a 1950s, like tobacco pipe. And he goes, I just thought you would dig it. And I was like, oh, thanks. I don't smoke, but okay. Thank you for the gift. And he's like, I'll see you around. And you know, he just leaves. And the long and the short of that was Zach. And so Zack Snyder. So he called me like a year later and said, hey, I'm going down to Chile. I want you to, you know, can you come down? I remember you were like rock climbing. Can you, you know, do some rigging for me? I was like, yeah, sure. And then after that job, I was going to Easter Island and he was coming back to cut in LA. And he was like, hey, I want you to be my first AD. And I was like, which is the assistant director. And I was like, Zach, I don't know how to do that. Like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm, I'm a grip and I kind of think I want to write, but, you know, and those guys are always yelling and screaming and like, I can't, you know, I don't want that kind of stress in my life. And he's like, well, I think you know, it's common sense and you can figure it out. And I was like, well, okay. So the long and the short of it is that I ended up being Zach's first AD for his whole like commercial career. So we got in, you know, we worked about a year non-union, and then for really from like the age of 20, like 1993 to 2003, like right until he did Dawn, we had a decade of just movies, commercials, like traveling all over the world, shooting over 1,000 days of shooting commercials. And during that time, I knew that I wanted to, you know, so of course, then I got to be 30 and I had a career. I was like, huh, I guess I'm not going to do that other thing. But I knew that I also didn't want to, that being a first AD, while it was very challenging and logistically challenging, that I wanted to be a little more creative. And so then Zach really embraced that. And we actually had written a couple things while we were kind of on the road in those, in that decade. One was a SWAT script that he was going to direct. They ended up not using that script and another director came on. It's the Colin Farrell, Samuel Jackson script, or that David Ayers wrote. But what that experience of just playing around with him and being creative with him, I was like, oh, this is a really lovely relationship. He went to do Dawn. And when he came back, that movie had been successful, that he's like, I want to do Frank. I want to do this book. And I'd never seen the book before that. This was, I think, in 2003, maybe. And he's like, check this book out, read it. And the book was amazing. I mean, it's, you know, it's beautifully rendered. It's super lean. And really the challenge was like, I mean, there were many challenges in making that into a script, let alone a movie, but that's kind of how I got to Frank. And I'd known his work from the 80s of Dark Knight and, you know, that kind of run that he did. And I was a huge fan. But I hadn't seen the 300 book and I really didn't even know a lot of the history, kind of just like I knew the names, but I didn't know the players and really what went down. So then we really got into writing that together, Zach and I. Yeah.
Is that kind of
the question?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of juicy stuff there. Is that also, yeah. Like, did you collaborate on the Rebel Moon? Like, how did you guys kind of decide to work together again for that one?
Yeah. Crazy. So, I mean, so obviously, you know, so to give you, you know, it's like, so I met Zach in 93. So we're, you know, deep into our third decade of just friendship, and we've seen the highs of each other's lives, and we've seen, you know, the tragedies and the lows of each other's lives. And so of just being friends. And so then as creative people, we've written a lot of movies. Some movies haven't been made. I've written a lot of movies for him that have yet to see daylight. But, you know, the ones, you know, we knew from 300 and then the sequel to that, and then the many of the projects that I wrote either for him, that we really had a fun relationship and we really trusted each other. That being said, so in 97, he actually brought up the idea of Rebel Moon to me on an airplane, flying back from a commercial that we were doing in Africa. And he was just like, what's your favorite movie? And I said, Seven Samurai. And he was like, oh my, he's like, that's a good one. He's like, mine's Star Wars. I was like, yeah, well, of course, Star Wars. Everyone's, you know, as a kid, love, you know, everyone's Star Wars changed their life. And so then he's like, wouldn't it be cool one day if we could make like Seven Samurai in Outer Space, like some kind of cool, like gunslinger kind of movie, and just pay homage to all the great movies, the Wild Bunch and Excalibur, and, you know, just all of our favorite movies. And I was like, yeah, sure. And I think we were like coming back from like a women's antiperspirant commercial or something. Like, I was like, sure, we just shot a commercial. I guess we'll do that one day, Zach. And of course, you know, the trajectory of his career went one way, mine went another way. We met a few times along the way to work with one another, but I think the interesting thing is that I watched him on all of the sets, you know, all of from Dawn all the way to, you know, I mean, certainly through the DCU run, like he was always refining like his just ability to execute, you know, what's inside his head and communicate that to hundreds of artists and technicians. And by the time we got to Rebel Moon, and like it was really during COVID, he said, you know, hey, I think we should, you know, and he'd taken shots at with Lucas. He was like, maybe it's a TV show, maybe it's a video game. He was just, you know, wondering what it is. And I think COVID really gave him the time to like think, no, I think we should write this as a movie. And he called me and we started talking about it, and then we did. And then about halfway through, I think we were about at page 100, he brought Shay. He said, do you mind if I bring Shay on, Shay Hatton, who's amazing? And Shay came in to really kind of work with all of us to get it to the finish line. Because it was, Zach had, he was going back to do his Justice League cut. And he just didn't have the bandwidth to kind of finish the pages that, you know, we just need to bring in another writer. And Shay was great. And he hit the ground running and, you know, just did a lot of heavy lifting. You know, at the end of movie one, certainly movie two, you know, there's a lot of stuff that Shay rolled in. So that's kind of the, it's been like a 20, I don't know, what is that, 28 year process conversation with Zach to get it to where, you know, where it is now. Yeah, pretty cool.
What's your, John Fusco first told me these phrases, like the wandering swordsman and the lone gunslinger. And it sounds like you're combining that idea. What's your take on that vibe of the samurai and the gunslinger and now like in outer space? How did you set the tone, or you guys set the tone?
I mean, I think, yes. So that's definitely there. I mean, I think all of those, we really leaned into, Zach and our huge fans of Joseph Campbell and kind of the Campbellian kind of the hero's journey or the hero of a thousand faces. So of course there's all of that. There's the reluctant gunslinger or the man with no name. So, and like any of those movies, it's pretty hard for me to like turn away if The Unforgiven is on, or like, you know, or any Clint Eastwood movie or any Sam Peckinpah movie. It's, I'm just like, oh my God, like this is really awesome. So I'd say, you know, it's definitely there. And some things are even really like, we're really kind of tipping our hat to, you know, and kind of giving a nod to the people that we love their movies. I mean, we named, you know, a character Milius after John Milius, cause he was such a rebel and a renegade in this town. I'm a huge fan of Milius. So, yeah, so I think that, you know, that those archetypes, you know, the stranger walks into town or the gunslinger, like those kinds of things were the movies that we all loved, or the, you know, Excalibur, you know, the sword with power, or mysticism and kind of magical realism of, I mean, even like, I mean, Zach references a lot, like, you know, this idea of like, of just it's kind of this heart attack serious world, but also there's just this little magical element that things happen where you're like, okay, wait a second, like okay, how are we, what are the rules? Do the rules just change to this world because we thought it was a gunslinging movie, but now there's like a princess that, you know, is, has some kind of like magical, you know, powers. So I think that that's kind of the fun of pushing those boundaries. And then, of course, he's painting on a canvas that is just like, you can solve problems very, very differently. In the, you know, for instance, one note that we got of like in movie one was like, oh, it's a very similar, like our Cora and Gunnar go into town and they go into a saloon and they, you know, and people were like, okay, it can't be like Mos Eisley. It can't be like Star Wars. It's not going to be like Star Wars because it's a very different, you know, this is a very grittier, different vibe where, you know, it's really, it's written as it's a brothel, it's a space brothel, you know, and that's what's, you know, so that's, that has nothing to do with Star Wars. Yeah. So it's just kind of having fun with it as much as you can.
You see your work, so like during that time, as an example, The Mandalorian came out. It's pretty much PG, I would say, in the Star Wars world. Do you see all your stuff as like rated R? Do you think about writing for adult audiences? How do you think about those things?
Yeah, it's this is the first. So these first two cuts that Zach did of Rebel Moon are PG-13. He will be at some point this year. He's doing his extended cuts, which are each an hour longer, and they're gonna be R. Probably they're gonna be a hard R. You know, knowing Zach, like he's gonna try to push the ragged edges of whatever he can get away with. I write, so I've always written R-rated movies. Not that if a movie can move me in some way, can I have some kind of human connection and to the character, I'm not adverse to writing a PG-13 or a PG movie or even a G-rated movie. Like, you know, I have an 11-year-old daughter who, you know, hasn't seen any of my movies, you know, even the PG-13 movie, because I'm like, no, it's not really appropriate yet. Like, one day you'll be able to see what your papa does when he's out in his office, but not yet. So I think for me, I always land on an R rating, just because I think that's the world I live in. You know, that the world is a complicated, messy place. Humans do really wonderful things for each other and do really hard, despicable things to each other on this planet. And I think that it just how I see the world is that, yeah, I can drive through to Los Angeles, I can see $10 million houses, and then I can see people sleeping on the street. And so it can be a both and that's an R-rated world. We live in an R-rated world in my mind. And if you, yeah. So I prefer, that's kind of where I always land. My tone is like, is going to be an R rating for sure.
It sounds like Zach's kind of found the sweet spot, because there's plenty of like cheap R movies, but also like X-Men was great, but then Logan came out and it was like, oh, this is what we wanted to see. We didn't know what we wanted to see, kind of thing. Is that how you see it?
Yeah. And that's, you know, it's a great example, because I love, you know, I love, and I'd worked with Jim Mangold prior to him actually doing the first Wolverine movie and then Logan, like, and he really like, because if you look at his movies prior, his R-rated movies, even like I'm speaking about Mangold, like Copland and like things like that, you're like, oh man, like this is really intense. Like, you know, it's an R-rated, you know, cop thriller. It's fantastic. And I think that I'll put it this way. Like, I think that, you know, that's a great example. Even Deadpool, which is certainly more comical and you know, and a little more self-deprecating in its like awareness of itself, the hero. But you know, I think that audiences are perfectly ready to go to the movie theater and see an R-rated superhero movie or to support those movies for sure. You know, and I think that those are the movies that really either I love the most or break my heart the most is an R-rated movie, because it just feels a little bit more like the real life, even though it's a made up movie.
I used to do commercials, and it felt like we got kind of stuck in commercials. Like, how did you and Zach, or maybe some advice on what Zach did to kind of break free and get into film and you know, make that transition?
Yeah, so the interesting thing about Zach is he was also he was always a cameraman director. So I think that kind of unified his vision in commercials. And he was always just really interested in story. I mean, certainly shooting a beautiful shot, you know, and we kind of used to I'll put it this way. We said this quite often, which is like, okay, here's the goal today, and it, whatever job we were on for a decade, you know, we were on a lot of them. We would say like the three things that we have to accomplish. We got to shoot we have to shoot some cool shots. We got to, you know, make sure the client's happy, shoot some cool shots. We got to, you know, we'll make some money, but most importantly, we got to go home safe. Like, let's not do anything that's so dangerous, that's so crazy. And we were doing like hanging off of camera cars and like helicopter. I mean, we were on the ragged edge of like kind of extreme commercial making in the 90s. Zach was really out there shooting a lot of, you know, there are times where I was like, that was super dangerous, but we came out the other side of it. So I think that for him, he always was looking for what is the story that I can tell, that I can use all of these skills that I've learned in hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of days of being on set and prepping and shooting. There's no difference than about laying dolly track down and telling a story in 30 seconds or 60 seconds and working with a crew on a commercial than there is. You're still telling a story in 30 seconds, you know, versus 3 minutes or 30 minutes or 3 hours. So it's all of those, the mechanical nature of it, which is interesting. And I guess what I'd say to that is that I'm not like, I think there's a bit of luck. Like he was very lucky, but then when he was given an opportunity to do his first movie, Dawn, he really just put his whole, like, I'm just going to make this visually as interesting as possible, and I'm going to make it mine. And I think that it's one of his, he wasn't really noted to death a lot on that movie. And personally, I didn't get it. Like at that time, I was like, zombie movie, like, okay, you know, go have fun. I didn't work on that movie, and it was a James Gunn script, which is cool. But you know, he was able to do enough with it that it had enough style that he was then able, and it made money, that was the thing that was the force multiplier in Hollywood. They're like, oh, you know, and I'm guessing at these numbers, but like, we gave him $30 million and it made $100 million. Okay, let's have him try it again. And then, of course, his second movie, they gave him $60 million and it made, you know, $400 or $500 million. And that was 300. And then it was like, that was kind of you're in the success matrix at that point.
Thanks so much for tuning into the show. Before you take off, I want to give you a free gift. I'm giving you my first book, Ink by the Barrel, for free. That's the digital download and audiobook at brockswenson.com. Inside this book, you'll learn how to annihilate writer's block by embracing Elizabeth Gilbert's playful trickster mentality. You can learn to weaponize your anxiety with Kevin Kelly's different is better approach, and learn how to defend your time with Ryan Holiday's calendar anorexia mindset. There's just a few other ideas in the book, Ink by the Barrel. It's also based on over 400 interviews I've done right here on Creative Principles. So go steal that book right now, Ink by the Barrel, to learn how to be a prolific writer. You can get your copy, that's digital download and audiobook, at brockswinson.com, brockswinson.com. And if it's your first time here, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Make sure to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode.